Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Disney Film Project Podcast. Woohoo! It's us. We are back with yet another rendition of our fine Disney film critiques. The show here is where we go through Disney films, stop, and briefly smell the roses before we plow forward into the fine depths of Disney film knowledge. I combined like 6 metaphors in 1 sentence right there.
Totally awesome.
Yes, thank you. I am Ryan Kilpatrick, the sole personage on DisneyFilmProject.com, which is the site where I attempt to watch Disney films and tell you what I think of them. My co-host for the evening, and really in life in general, Mr. Todd Perlmutter, first up, blogger at TouringPlans.com, chief technical officer at DisneyDrivenLife.com, swell guy, and who is apparently on a meat embargo. Welcome, Todd. How are you, sir?
Hi. Well, you know, you eat at like Le Cellier and then Ohana before that, you kind of get like full of meat and just need to stop for a few days.
Did you go into like a meat coma?
After Ohana, I sure did. but let me tell you, Wish is way better with meat.
They should put that on the vacation planning DVD. Wishes, way better with me. Our other co-host, the one and only Miss Brianna Alessio. She is a blogger, and she blogs at Adventures of Bree at adventuresofbree.blogspot.com. I believe she's actually buried in snow at the moment and cannot speak. Or is that incorrect?
I am buried under a whopping 2 inches. It's frightening. I don't know how to handle it.
For those of us who live in the South, that is buried.
True. And you know what? The sad part is we were all ready to put our signs away because, you know, we were protesting.
Right.
And all of a sudden the snow returns. It's such a disappointment.
I remember
it's because you put the signs away.
Yeah.
Why? You know, you put the shovels away, you put the signs away, and it all comes back.
Murphy's Law. It happens.
Yep.
The most important part of the show, Ms. Cheryl Perlmutter, the lovely and talented producer who I believe already has 17 edits in this show, and we haven't even started talking about the movie. Hello, Cheryl. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I know you're excited to talk about this movie.
I am. I am indeed. Although doing the research for this movie got me a little sad, but that's okay.
We were supposed to do research?
Oops.
No!
System fail!
We have a breakdown in the system.
Warning. Danger.
I am going to be derezzed for my lack of research. The movie we are discussing this evening is The Happiest Millionaire, released in June of 1967 from Walt Disney Productions. It is a story starring the lovely and talented Miss Leslie Ann Warren and John Davidson in, I guess you'd call them sort of the lead roles. The title role played by Fred McMurray. There are lots of great actors and actresses throughout the film that we will discuss. Music by the Sherman Brothers. And Woo! It was a... Thank you. Big ups to the Shermans.
Yeah.
It was a movie with, how shall I put this, multiple lengths. Sort of interesting in that regard. we can talk about that if you would like to.
There were 4 different lengths to this movie, right? Originally, then they took it on the road. It was 172 minutes long, which is huge by today's standards, right?
It's like Gilligan's Island. It was a 3-hour tour.
There you go. Okay. But they cut it down because they thought it was just a little too long to about 160 minutes for actual theater release. Yep. But then it didn't do so well in the theater. So then they cut it down again to 144 minutes. And, it was still hemorrhaging money. So they cut it to 118 minutes.
That didn't work either.
No, it didn't, because they just took it out of the theater eventually.
Yeah.
But despite that, it has it's actually relished for its soundtrack. Because
indeed.
It's really all about the soundtrack in this movie. The story is interesting too, but the soundtrack is what really makes it. But in order to get all the songs, you have to get the full-length version, which is called the Roadshow Edition, which is what I think most of us watched.
That is the one that I received from both Netflix and Amazon because I was not sure which one would get here in time for me to finish the movie about, 20 minutes ago. And I got the Roadshow version, and as I mentioned, it was the 3-hour Gilligan's Island tour that I wasn't sure would ever end. Even though I was enjoying it, I was worried I would not be finished with the film in time for the recording of this here show.
I watched the lovely 144-minute edition from the lovely Perlmutter family.
Yes, we had multiple copies.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me. So was one of them your copy, Todd, and one of them was Cheryl's? And if so, who had the Roadshow version and who had the short version?
Jasper has the Roadshow version.
So I think what happened is we moved once and Cheryl misplaced it, so we bought it again. And it was the shorter version. Then we rediscovered that where we misplaced the Roadshow edition to.
No, not true.
No?
No.
Not true. Okay, go.
Not true. We had bought The Happiest Millionaire. We had it on the shelf. And then we're walking at Best Buy. And we had seen the Roadshow edition. And I'm like, wait, another edition of Happiest Millionaire. I have never seen this. I have to buy it. And then it was history.
No, so the Roadshow edition is actually so long that you actually have to flip your DVD over.
You set me up and you didn't let me do the punchline there.
Oh, there was a punchline for what?
Da, 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 da.
Oh. The Roadshow edition is so long.
How long is it?
You have to flip the DVD over. It's insane. The very beginning is in old style theater going. People may not realize this. Is movies were not on a single reel like they are today because the projectors just couldn't be built big enough to support a reel that would just allow the one reel to go through, and they didn't have automatic changers back then. So they would actually seat the audience, wait until the audience was completely seated. Hard to believe that people would not actually walk in after the movie started once upon a time. And then they would start the movie. So during that time when people were walking into the theater, they would actually have a still or something up on the screen or slideshow. That's where that comes from modern day movies. And they'd actually be playing music while people were coming into the theater. Kind of sort of, again, what we do today, but except that people then just were all there by the time the movie started. Then they would have this concept of intermission so that while it took the 15 minutes to change the reel, that people could go out, buy more concessions, and then come back in. And it was about 6 minutes long, usually, typically, was the time for intermission. And so literally, you get the intermission at the end of the first side, and then you flip it over, and then you continue the movie.
Yeah, see, you must have had a different version, because mine I did not have to flip, but it still had the overture and the intermission in there.
Oh.
And so the first 5 minutes of the movie is literally the overture slide. And I was like, if this movie is 3 hours long, and there's only just a little picture on screen, I'm going to be upset. Timed it. It was 5 minutes long.
Like I said, six minutes is about what it used to was the standard time for those sorts of things.
Yeah. So the movie opens with or at least the Roadshow version opens with the overture. Did you have the overture on yours, Brie?
No, yeah. I did not.
You missed out on one overture screen with a lot of music for 5 straight minutes.
Oh, I'm good. Thanks.
I say that with the music.
I gave Reed the brief edition on purpose.
That.
The music is quite lovely, so it's not necessarily a bad thing. I just was wondering what in the Sam Hill was going on.
Well, it's the fortuosity, which I know you're going to get to in a second, that I wanted to pull the hair out of my head because I thought it would never end.
Okay, so yes, the film starts with it's again another Disney film set in the early aughts or teens of the 1900s.
It takes place in Philadelphia in the year 1916, and it's September 1916 through I think June of 1917.
Yeah, it sounds about right. I didn't draw a chart, but I know you have it. So
I read the beginning of the book.
There you go. And the film opens with a young Irishman named John Lawless, played by Tommy Steele, and he is walking through this, you know, this town, and he starts singing the aforementioned Fortuosity song. Now, Brie is threatening to kill herself if she has to listen to the song again. I actually did not mind the, I didn't mind the song as much. So the premise of the song is he's saying, like, you know, good luck just comes to him, and that's how he's going to get this job as a butler in Philadelphia. And it does go on a bit long, but I'm looking forward to it because it's part of the Main Street loop at Disneyland and at Walt Disney World. The
really?
Version. Yeah.
Yep.
Next time you walk into the Main Street, you'll hear it and you'll recognize it instantly.
And I'll start screaming in the park. Yeah.
Not doing a jig?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I have to do the Irish jig, of course. Yeah, you know, the thing about Tony Steele, during that scene, he reminds me of Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins, like the way he's dancing and everything. But then when the song continues, that's when the blood starts coming out of your eyeballs. Like, stop. Sorry.
Actually, does it's a good point because John Lawless does kind of play the Dick Van Dyke role in this, even though he's not in the movie. He's not as central to the film as Bert was to Mary Poppins. He does play the narrator, fourth wall breaking guy on occasion. There's a great scene towards the
last half, where he's breaking the fourth wall and he starts talking to you, and Mr. Beetle's head comes into the picture, and, which is Fred McMurray, and he looks and he goes, "Who are you talking to?"
I love that.
And he goes, "That was fantastic." And he goes, "No one." And then he smiles back and winks at us.
that was fantastic. That was one of the funniest movies and the funniest parts of the entire film. But so John goes to the aforementioned Mr. Biddle's house to apply as the butler, and chaos ensues. Would be the way I would put it.
It was funny because unlike where Mary Poppins hires herself, he kind of just ends up hired, right? They just assume he has the position. Mr. Biddle and Cordy assume that he's already got the job from their mother, and when she shows up, she just kind of starts handing him stuff also. So she's just already said, well, you're here, that's better than anybody else, so here you go.
No matter the fact that he tries to run out the door at one point, he doesn't make it.
No.
No.
He tries to escape, and yeah, he couldn't do it. Right. But he does end up fitting in well with them. You know.
Yes, he does. I like that he comes from Mayflower Employment, which was an actual employment company, right? So I thought that was interesting. The chocolate cake diet. What a great diet, huh?
Yeah,
I want that.
I mean, I love it, every essential element. That's why he was eating it. I like that because it was just awesome and alliterative.
So we should talk some about we say chaos ensues, but I'm going to go out on a limb and think that most of the people listening have not actually seen this movie because I had never seen it before. I don't know, Bree, had you seen this before?
Never, no.
I should preface this by saying that if you are a Disney fan, you should go see it, or you should rent it or something.
Agreed.
Because it's my favorite movie. That's why. Let's do it. I didn't lose it too.
Do it for Cheryl.
Do it for mankind.
In my case, it's not just that it's a Disney movie, but I'm a huge Fred McMurray fan. My favorite all-time Fred McMurray movie is Double Indemnity with Barbara Stanwyck.
Me too.
Which is probably one of the best movies ever made.
I agree.
So
it is on my DVR right now.
See? Awesome. Such an excellent movie.
So. There you go. Of course, he plays a much different character between the two movies.
Yes. That's putting it mildly.
Because he plays this great wooden character in Double Indemnity, but here he plays something very different, which I think we were getting to is the chaos that was ensuing.
Yeah, so when John enters the Biddle household, which Mr. Anthony Drexel Biddle is Fred McMurray's character, who is the titular millionaire of this piece. He is an eccentric, would be the nice way to put it. Off his rocker would be the normal person way to put it. I mean, he's just nuts, but in a good way. Right? There's nuts in a bad way, and that would be the Double Indemnity example. And there's nuts in a good way, and this is in the good way. In that he just he does all of these things that you wouldn't expect a person of his position to do, which I guess is kind of the point. He keeps alligators. He has a boxing and Bible class, and no, those two things are not separate.
That's the same class. Yes.
Yes.
So, it's important to note. So he's in the time of this movie, he's 40 or 41 years old, roughly at the time of the movie, the character. And, he's at this point where he's was born into money. Okay. The Biddles were in. Okay. Do we want to talk about the real life side of this, or do we want to save that for later?
Oh, can we please save that for later? That's so depressing.
Okay.
So
he's got time on his hands. So he's got this Bible school, and he says he's got three things he believes in. Right. That's the important thing. It's the flag above, the Bible, and love. That's all this guy believes in, and that's the song. Is he's so eccentric that he has alligators as pets. Okay, and there's 12 of them in their household. They have their own little parlor room with bathtub with
conservatory.
Like,
the conservatory.
I couldn't remember what it was with the candlestick,
yes.
And he sits there and he plays with them, and he comes in, and apparently one of them has bitten his finger. Now let's face it, if it had actually bitten his finger, there would be no finger left. It's an alligator. Okay, but beyond that, he's coming in and he's going, "Where is my family?" And then he starts singing this song called "What's Wrong with That," and it's to me, this was the same as the song in Mary Poppins, you know, where he's
the life I lead,
right?
Yeah,
it's not the same song, but it's there for the same purpose, to introduce the character and his thought processes, so you understand the character right up front as soon as he's introduced.
Yeah,
only
no,
Biddle is disgruntled because George bit him.
That's right, George bit him.
It's a good comparison because it's the song, his saying "What's wrong with that?" and it comes back again a few other times in the movie. Is basically his way of saying, like, yes, I know I'm strange, but here's what I think, and what's wrong with that? And frankly, when he lays it out the way that he does in the song, you kind of go, "Oh, yeah, okay, that makes sense." then you step back for a second and go, "No, that's nuts."
he's upset because he's screaming at the top of his lungs. He's really not even bleeding. Okay, I mean, there's no blood involved. He's just holding up his finger and he wraps a towel around it, and he's going, "Where's my wife? Where's my children? I raised them well." Yada yada. That's the whole song, right? And he's, unlike Mr. Banks, he is actually aware of his family, though. That's the
very
fundamental
aware.
Difference.
Oh, yeah,
so.
Very much.
Yeah. But there's a whole kind of a swirling chaos of the first, I guess, probably the first half hour of the movie after the five-minute overture, where we get introduced to all the family members, as well as Mrs. Worth, the, I don't know if she's the maid or the cook or whomever,
maid.
But it's... Is she the maid? Because then there's another maid later that's never really explained why there is, but Mrs. Worth, who's played by Hermione Baddeley, who was also the maid in Mary Poppins. So I guess she just enjoyed being a maid on film. But we had Mrs. Worth, we have Cordy, that we mentioned already, who's played by the lovely and talented Leslie Ann Warren, also later in Clue, where she, I think, did kill somebody in the conservatory with a candlestick.
You may be right.
Could be. The two sons, Tony and Liv, which I presume is short for Livingston.
Yeah, it's,
I presume.
Liv is short for Livingston. Tony is short for Anthony Biddle, because he's Anthony Biddle Jr.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So,
who show up to intimidate a gentleman caller who's about to take Cordy out on a date, and then they disappear for the next 2.5 hours.
So they explain that, actually, in the movie. He says at one point, he mentions the boarding school that they go off to, which is St. Paul's in Concord, New Hampshire. And so they've gone back to school after the scene where they knock poor Charlie out.
Right. I just found it amusing. Like, they come in and they do a song and dance number, they knock the kid out, and then there they go.
You know, I kind of forgot about them as I watched the film. Now that you guys mentioned, I'm like, hey, wait, where did they go?
Tony was played by Paul Peterson, and he was actually Jeff from the Donna Reed Show, which is, you know, one of the main characters from the Donna Reed Show, and he was on, I think, almost every episode of that show.
Also, what I thought was interesting about Paul Peterson is he's now apparently has his own organization for minors who are film stars, and he kind of works with them in making sure that they get the correct class sizes and stuff, class hours, and they're going to they get enough school time and stuff like that. I thought that was really interesting, especially since like we're talking about Wizards lately, because in Wizards, if you know, Max was replaced with Maxine. And right. I actually had researched this. It turns out that he actually goes to, like, real school. So that's why he was replaced out, because he had to go to school.
There you go.
Interesting. Liv was played by Eddie Hodges, who was the Huckleberry Finn who was in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And also appeared a couple times on Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color. So,
woohoo!
There you go.
The absolutely wonderful world of color.
All right.
But the kind of the capper for the poor John Lawless who's gets swept into this chaos and everyone just assumes he's the butler, like Todd said, is when Aunt Mary shows up, played by Gladys Cooper. And Aunt Mary, so we described the craziness of Mr. Biddle and the Bible boxing classes and all this kind of stuff. So Aunt Mary serves as the old money person to come in and say that this is not the way you should be, in her very haughty and disapproving tone. And she comes in right before Mr. Biddle's wife, Cordelia, who obviously is the mother of Cordy, who played by Leslie Ann Warren, who is also Cordelia, but they call her Cordy. And the wife, Cordelia, is played by Greer Garson, who I think, my opinion, is my favorite character in the film, just in the way that she deals with everything that's going on.
Kind of off topic, is she the one that played the lead role in Goodbye, Mr. Chips? Do you remember that film?
I remember the film, and I don't remember if you are correct, but I think you might be.
It's a Google moment.
I wanted to say it was either Gladys Cooper or Greer Garson. I think it's Gladys Cooper. This was her last film.
It was, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're correct. Right.
I'm not sure which one it was.
So for
it was not Greer Garson, it was Gladys Cooper.
Gladys Cooper, yeah.
And yes, she was, Bree. She was the lead in Goodbye, Mr. Chips.
Yeah.
Okay,
She was also Professor Higgins' mom in Mrs. Higgins in My Fair Lady.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, how about that?
Look at that.
Yep. Now, I love when she walks in and George is still... Mr. Biddle is still complaining about George biting his finger. And he goes, I honestly don't know what got into him. And she goes, quite honestly, your finger got into him. And she goes, and anyone who keeps an alligator in the house deserves to be bit.
This is Aunt Mary who says this.
Not the elder Cordelia, because the daughter's also named Cordelia.
Right. Aunt Mary is meant to be an unlikable character, I think, but frankly, she's kind of amusing.
But and actually not the least likable character in the movie. So.
Agreed, yes. Completely agree. But the whole reason for Aunt Mary's visit is she's very upset because Cordy, the younger Cordy, has apparently been boxing.
No, she won the two-step competition.
Yeah, she went to a dancing competition. Is what she won, not a boxing competition.
I thought she was upset because she was
no.
Don't be me. I know that she won the two-step competition, but she
no, she won the, no, this. She won the two-step competition with a boxer.
Perlmutter.
Uh oh, he's gonna do a tiki room fist shake here.
I am.
No, she won the two-step competition with one of his boxers.
Agreed. But she is also upset at the fact that Cordelia knows how to box, right?
Yes, that is one of yes, it is. She also wants her to be more ladylike and go to boarding school. That's why she's there.
That's where I was headed with that.
Sorry.
Oh yeah.
But you are correct. The premise of the visit is the fact that Cordy won the two-step contest in Atlantic City, and it was in the papers. And that's kind of the premise. But then she kind of digresses into all the other things that are wrong with Cordy, and ends up saying that she wants her to go to boarding school, which Cordy steps in and agrees to, even though her father does not want her to go, because she's daddy's little girl. Did I summarize that effectively?
Yes. Yeah. And I love that he's this man of health, and yet he's smoking cigars like at least several times throughout the movies. Throughout the movie.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
And then this is one of them. He gets upset that she's going because he's. It's not that she's a daddy's girl. It's that he is so attached to her that he gets very upset when she wants to leave, and he reluctantly agrees and says, "Well, go if you want to go," because she says she wants to go.
Right.
And that's because just before this scene, she has a moment up in her room where she's questioning her identity, almost in a like a Mulan sort of way. Right. That's she's having that moment she's singing just like Mulan is singing into the lake. She's singing into a mirror, and she's like, "Am I boxing or am I, you know?"
Valentine's candy.
Right. Yeah. That's I couldn't remember what it was. Valentine candy is a song.
Right.
And so that was the whole thing. And so now she comes down and she convinces herself that yes, this is a good idea for her to do, and her father reluctantly agrees, and she gets upset that he agrees and storms off.
Right. And it's kind of the theme of the film is the fact that her father's trying to remain young, even though he's only 40 years old. He's trying to remain young, and he kind of relies on Cordy for some of that. And the boys, too, even though they disappear. He relies on his children to keep him young, and the activities that he does, the Bible boxing class and those sorts of things, he relies on to keep him young. And not in a selfish way, but he relies on them, and he enjoys having them around, and that's kind of the theme of the film, is that Cordy wants to be her own woman, and he wants to keep her around, and that's the conflict of the movie.
Yes. But, I mean, not long after this, though, he runs out to the stables, which is actually the gym where the Bible class is held, which we can get to in a little bit, because we actually haven't seen the Bible class at this point in the movie yet.
Right.
And she's out there, and she's, you know, punching a punching bag, and then she moves over to one of the hanging punching bags that you do two fists with, and he stops her, and they have a brief conversation where they make up, and he tells her, you know, just like boxing in life, you have to have your guard up, your chin tucked, and bring one up from the floor.
Right. Which comes back later.
Yes, it does.
so then in another strange turn, at least to me, we leave Mr. Biddle, who has been the central character of the film for the first, 45 minutes, I'd say?
Yeah,
it's close, yeah.
Yeah. He disappears for the next half hour, at least, of the 3-hour epic. And we basically follow Cordy on her journey through boarding school, where she learns from her roommate.
Wait, you skipped a bunch of things. Irish.
That's right. You skipped I'll Always Be Irish.
Oh, gosh.
so
perhaps on purpose.
Perhaps on purpose.
Word!
Oh, I don't know. I enjoy the song.
I love that song.
Okay, are the Irish ones here?
Yes.
Yeah,
I know.
I enjoy the first
Irish
song.
Irish?
That's right. Cheryl is actually Irish also.
Really?
My family's name is Goldthwait. Goldthwait.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And yet you skipped Darby O'Gill and the Little People. And you call yourself Irish.
I had to be at a meeting, sorry.
I'm just saying. All right. There's a wonderful lengthy song called "I'll Always Be Irish," where John, the new butler, sings and enlists. That's kind of where he becomes the official butler, I guess.
That's right, because Mrs. Biddle, she's on the employment company, calls in the middle of the song, and Mrs. Biddle goes into the phone booth, and she's like, she's going, she can't hear them, and she's like, "Oh, it's the Mayflower Employment Agency. Oh yes, he'll fit in just fine." And she's parading her husband and her daughter Cordy around to the whole song and everything like that. And
I wanted to say some quotes from this song.
Go for it.
Oh my.
He'll be American as Irish Stew. He'll also be as American as Casey and the Bat. Mrs. Worth's father was a tornado on the floor. And then I bet someday we get an Irish president.
That's actually an important line, because this movie came out in 1967, which was just after, one term after Kennedy was in office and had been assassinated. Now, but wait, here's why this is there's actually a connection here. Now, Angier Biddle Duke, who is the daughter of Angie and who's the son of Angie and Cordy, was actually the chief
in real life version
of him was actually the chief protocol officer under Kennedy. And when Kennedy was assassinated, his entire the thing that made him famous was how he handled the protocol for all the world's leaders who came to visit at the funeral.
Oh wow!
So so there is actually a double tie there in the movie. So
and then he says, "I want George to see this."
That's right. And that's when John learns about what's in the conservatory.
Which is not a candlestick, it's alligators.
12 alligators that Mr. Biddle in the movie claims he captured in the Florida Everglades by Seminole Indians.
There's an hour of the film for every alligator.
That's awesome.
The song is not as bad as Fortuosity, but it's so close.
But it's not that they're bad. It's just that they just keep going.
Yes.
And it's like you kind of get the point after a little while.
Yeah. It's like I've almost lost all my hair from listening to those two songs.
No, I actually enjoy, and that's what I mean. Like, I actually enjoy the songs, you know, but after a while, you go, okay, I got it. Thank you.
Breathe, choir. I'll tell Mrs. Winfield that you're wearing rouge.
Which leads us back to where Ryan thought we were.
Yes, yeah. Which is Cheryl was quoting from Cordy blackmailing her roommate, or trading, as they call it in the film, her roommate to teach her how to lure men with feminine wiles, shall we say, if I may read the Wikipedia page, so I give appropriate credit.
God bless Wikipedia.
Yeah, indeed. It was an interesting scene of Cordy learning how to dance in a certain way.
Yes.
Pum-pum. Yes. Speaking of songs that go on way too long,
right?
I actually feel that song went on longer than the other ones did. The other ones were okay, but this one was needlessly long.
Right.
Yeah.
She makes a blackmail trade with her roommate Rosemary to learn how to flirt with boys, like Ryan was saying, and. Rosemary responds by teaching her how to move across the dance floor and they do this song called Bayum Pum Pum. And it's not like risque or anything like that. It's just very odd for a song because the whole song they're dancing around and, you know, the oh so mysterious. Yeah, song. There you go.
How's the rest of it go, Todd?
No, it just goes Bayum Pum. Pum, bam, pum, pum. That's like half the song right there. It's easy. It's easy. Most of the characters in the movie have real life counterparts, right? The only two that I'm pretty sure have no real life counterparts, and I would love for somebody to like tell us on Twitter or something if I'm wrong, are Rosemary, her roommate, and John Lawless himself. There's no actual anything about what the name of the butler was that I could find in real life. So I think he's the made up character for the movie. Because he doesn't have a Wikipedia page. He's not mentioned on anybody else's Wikipedia pages or in their IMDb profiles or anything like that.
Okay.
So Rosemary is played by Joyce Bulifant, and she was famous for being on the Bill Cosby Show. That's not Cosby from the 80s, folks. That's the original Bill Cosby Show. And Mary Tyler Moore as well.
More for Mary Tyler Moore than...
More for Mary Tyler Moore, that's correct.
Okay, yeah, no, okay, now that you say that, I remember, okay. I remember her from Mary Tyler Moore. I don't remember the original Bill Cosby Show.
I don't remember either from Bill Cosby Show either, so.
Bree, do you know who Mary Tyler Moore is?
Oh, please, Ryan, really? I love the show.
Okay, I'm just checking.
She knew Dick Van Dyke. Chances were there that she knew who Mary Tyler Moore was.
Thank you, Todd.
My next quote is that that Cordy says, one thing I liked, is it helps to be related to almost everybody. When we're near Irish, you have tons of second cousins, tons of third cousins.
It's not just that, though. This family is insanely connected. The Biddles in real life, it's not, so it's not just a made-up thing for the movie, okay? But I don't want to get into it because it'll jump the gun on the actual story, so we'll talk about all the connections after we get through a bit more of the story.
So, segue, the Duke family is also well-connected. And Cordy meets an Angier Buchanan Duke, who Cordy calls Angie. I'm not sure if I were he that I would be very... I might go by Buchanan if I were him.
Oh, yeah.
Rather than...
Bucky.
Yeah, something. Rather than Angie or Angers. But they meet at Aunt Gladys's party, and they do a waltz to the song Are We Dancing, which I did not realize was from this movie. I don't know why I didn't. I've heard that song many, many times before, but I didn't realize it was from this.
Yes. And it's a very Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers moment.
Yeah.
Because they literally, they're in this room with all these other people, and they're kind of taking off the dance floor, and then all of a sudden they kind of move slowly out the door onto this balcony that's huge.
Because everyone has one of those.
That's right. And they're dance alone on this balcony, and nobody else follows them out or anything. They literally have this whole dance floor to themselves now. And it's a really beautiful moment, actually, for what it is.
Yeah.
And, no, and you haven't learned what a nut job he is at this point either, so.
Oh, Angie's the nut job?
I think the whole family, both families are nut jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's safe to say.
Yeah.
But so they go out on the balcony and out in the night, and he starts talking about the Rolls Royce he sees, which is kind of a clue that he's a bit of a car nerd.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a Rolls Royce Silver Ghost, which he does not. It's apparently his favorite car ever. So.
Right. But he doesn't. It's not at this moment. But that's a tip to. I'm kind of skip ahead, and then we'll come back. But a later moment where he and Cordy are sitting in an ice cream parlor, and he reveals to her and sings a song about Detroit. And basically he reveals that his dream, rather than being in the tobacco business, which is what his family is known for, he would like to go to Detroit and be a car maker.
Yes.
And he sings a whole song about Detroit, Michigan, which should make all those Detroit folks very happy.
Which what makes me wonder today, if he was a real person, would we have bailed him out?
Who knows?
Would he been really successful and we wouldn't be in this predicament?
But correct me if I'm wrong here. This is completely fabricated. We've kind of hinted at this, that this was based on a real life story.
Yes.
But the whole Detroit part was not.
I don't find any mention of the Detroit stuff at all in the actual stuff. And we'll get to why. I think there's a big chunk of about the Dukes that was cut out of the movie, and I think that's why the Detroit thing comes into play.
Right.
But we haven't actually discussed the origin of the actual book or anything, like, or where the whole movie comes from to begin with anyway. So we'll get to that. They have this great little newspaper montage next, which would be entitled Mr. Biddle Goes to Washington, which is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Mr. Smith
right?
Goes to Washington. So, with the fabulous James Stewart,
actual filibuster.
Yes.
As opposed to what passes for filibusters these days. Sorry. My political thing.
That's fair, yes.
Let me explain that. They don't actually, if you've ever seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, they don't actually make people stand on the floor and talk anymore when they do a filibuster, which is annoying because we've all seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and seen Jimmy Stewart standing there on the floor doing a filibuster, and then you hear that somebody filibustered something and they didn't actually do that. And I think they should, because it would be very entertaining.
That's right. In fact, modern filibusters, the person who has the floor doesn't even have to remain on the floor anymore. They can have a stand-in now.
Right.
Which is ridiculous.
I'm just saying, I'm not saying it from a political point of view. I'm saying it from a pure entertainment point of view. I want to see people standing on the floor talking for 37 straight hours. Just saying.
Yeah.
For that digression.
No, there's an episode of West Wing where they do the super long filibuster, and it's actually very entertaining because they're giving the guy like textbooks to read out of, and
yes, because they find out because in West Wing they find out that his son had some disease or something, and they actually have to go in and save him too. That's one of part of it as well.
I remember that. So Mr. Bill gets kicked out of Washington. That's the long and short of the newspaper montage.
Yeah, because he wants to offer his Bible boxing folk.
That's
to get us involved in World War II, which, if you remember your history, we're not involved in 1916, and by we, I mean the United States.
That's right, and this is actually very important, because Woodrow Wilson is president at this point in time, right? And it's the end of 1916, which means Woodrow Wilson is running for re-election. His entire platform was actually based on the United States staying out of the war, which is actually interesting, because by the time, I think it's April of 1917... Woodrow Wilson actually has Congress declare war, because the time period between when he gets elected to April of 1917, the Lusitania, because the Germans start to make a pact with Mexico to sink U.S. warships, and then Lusitania.
Yes, they sink the Lusitania, and we declare war on Germany.
Correct.
For the first time.
For the first time.
Yes, but not the last.
And Mr. Biddle returns. So Mr. Biddle gets kicked out of Washington, and he comes back, and apparently there's a concession made, okay? And some Marines are sent to visit Mr. Biddle and help Mr. Biddle train his Bible class in close combat, okay? And they start to belittle him a little bit when they show up, and so he takes them to the stable, which is where the Bible class actually occurs, and he convinces one of them to box with him, okay? And this was actually a mistake for that poor Marine. because he teaches this Marine a lesson, and it's really done well. I have to say, I mean, I know they're just actors and it's not real boxing or anything like that, but it looks and feels like a real moment. And I just enjoyed this scene not because they're beaten on a Marine, he's beaten on a Marine, but because he's really you learn that through the craziness, he actually has a certain level of focus. Okay. And I kind of sort of relate to that because I'm a little crazy and I have a certain level of focus too. So.
And you enjoy beating on Marines, apparently.
Sorry, go.
No, it's okay. You can do the one
comment I wanted to make is that apparently after the guy loses, the guy pulls him aside and goes, "We'll make a deal with you. Just don't tell that you just bested the best guy in the squadron."
Yes, that's true. So apparently he was the boxer of the squadron, and he had won the championship in the Marine squadron that they were in, and that's why they put him up. But they thought he was a ringer, but it turns out that Mr. Biddle was the real ringer, and that's where it came from. And it's very funny because he gets John Lawless to time the match, and John Lawless is very entertaining in this scene too, and because they knock the picture off the wall, and he says, "Oh, I'll be right behind you with the picture." But the Marines instantly make up with him afterwards. They're singing with him afterwards, and that was their bonding moment. I mean, they just Mr. Biddle is in with the Marines, which is what Mr. Biddle wants.
Yes. For some reason.
For some reason.
Yes.
And then we get to your soda shop scene.
Yes, and that's when we have the soda shop, and they start singing about Detroit, Michigan, and all those wonderful things.
Detroit.
Which led to a fun. A fun moment between the Sherman brothers and Walt. Did you guys read about that?
No, this is actually very entertaining. So in Detroit, right, one of the lyrics is, it's FOB Detroit, right? But the Sherman brothers are...
Which stands for freight on board.
It stands for freight on board, okay? But Walt heard it while walking down one of the hallways, and he thought it was SOB, which I won't say what SOB is. Remember, remember again, folks, if your children's understand, it's your fault, not ours. Walt got very upset with this, and he started berating them about it until they explained what they had actually sung, and then they just kind of like laughed it off. But it's still very entertaining.
Very much so. But so we have the whole Detroit, Michigan sequence, and it's kind of where the Cordy and Angie really cement the fact that they're in love, and we come back with Cordy showing up back at the Biddle's house a little later
and announcing her engagement to Angie.
I had a question here.
Oh wait! Now, before she gets there.
Yeah, there's no. There's something happens before that. Yes. Before she actually arrives, don't forget the most important scene in the whole movie happens, Ryan.
Oh boy!
But I have a question about this couple though. Now this might just be the way that Leslie Ann Warren has that stare about her, like she kind of like talks but looks off into space at times. I mean, even modern day, she does the same thing where she's talking at someone, but it looks like she's looking like over there, like when I look up at the screen over here.
She did it on The Muppet Show, too, I just have to say. Season 2. Okay. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Just saying, she hosted The Muppet Show. She did it there.
She did. So did many people.
There you go.
And I got this feeling that, and I don't know if it was intentional from the direction of the movie, that Cordy never actually was as in love with Angie as she was letting on, because the whole montage of them driving along, fixing the car, he's singing Detroit, because Detroit goes on for much longer than practically any other song in the movie, by the way,
which is saying something.
Yeah. But this montage is very funny, because every time they start driving and then there's a cut and then the car's broken down and they're either fixing it or pushing it along, and then suddenly they're back in the car and it's going again, and then they're fixing it and it's moving along, and then finally the car breaks down right at the end of the song, okay? And it starts to rain, and then we go to the next really most important scene.
Well, no. Well, before that, it's get in. My quote is...
Okay. Cheryl has song quotes again.
No. Mr. Bill says, get an axe, not for the maid, and find a way to run a prison.
Oh, well, okay. So, this is, right, but this is, we haven't actually discussed those scenes yet. So, right after the Detroit song, you get the scene that I like to refer to as Frozen Alligators. Because Mr. Biddle and Mrs. Biddle come home and they realize that there's a chill coming into the house from somewhere, the mansion from somewhere. And they look around and it's coming from the conservatory, and they rush into the conservatory because Mr. Biddle's like, oh no, what's going on? And they find that all the alligators have been frozen solid in their little wading pools. And they're freaking out and they don't know what to do. And they find out that the windows are open, and the new maid, who we haven't actually seen the new maid yet, she's left all the windows open because she didn't like the smell. And he goes, what smell? And John is right there, and he goes, the alligators, sir. They smell.
No. The best again is Greer Garson, who says, Cordelia, who says, we're used to it, dear.
we're used to it. That's right. So there's this whole scene where he shouts, get an axe! And John's like, why? You can't kill the maid. And he goes, no, it's to break them out, because we might be able to save them if we can chop them out. And they get them, they pull them out in front of the fire, and they realize
they're dead.
They keep going, they're dead. And even Mrs. Biddle picks them up and goes, dead, dead. You know, that's all they keep saying.
Dead.
But here's the important thing, folks. Reptiles are cold-blooded, so when they get cold to a certain point of coldness, they actually go into a state of hibernation called torpor, okay? And so they actually are asleep at this point, just they don't realize, the Biddles don't realize this. So they just leave the frozen alligators lying all over the house. And at this point, Cordelia comes home, so I'll let Ryan pick back up.
Well, because
thank you, Wonky Sluice.
What else would you do with frozen crocodiles or alligators but leave them lying around the house?
I think it's very important.
Frozen dead crocodiles make great potted plants. Just saying.
Or handbags.
There you go.
Or food.
Yeah, the maid who, as I referred to earlier, shows up out of nowhere. We have no reason to know why the maid has showed up, but there she is. But yes, Cordy comes home and she announces that she's engaged. I know, shocking, huh? But... It's kind of a weird thing, because Mr. Biddle, you know, as we know, does not want to lose his little girl. And Angie shows up after he pulls around and Cordelia announces the engagement, I should say, and Mr. Biddle is not very happy about it, doesn't respond well. So it's a rough night, right? His alligators have died and his little girl's leaving.
Right, but he's not, and she won't let him meet Angie yet. She actually sends Angie off to another and says, "No, no, you'll meet him when I think you're ready to meet him."
Right. Which it's not what you say to your father.
Right. And he again gets very upset. And we have this moment where the Biddles are the elder Biddles, Mr. and Mrs. Biddle, are going upstairs to their room or something like that. And I love this line because he said they're having this conversation and she reads him like a book. She knows exactly what's going on in his head and the whole thing. And he says to her, "Cordelia, sometimes you scare me." And she goes, "I certainly hope so." Which is because it's Greer Garson. Greer Garson has this ability to deliver lines that are such few words, but they sound so cool when she says them.
Exactly. That is exactly the way to put it, because she doesn't have a lot of lines in the film and she's not really in it that all too much, but she makes every little moment count, which is right. Really fun.
So at this point, John Lawless turns to the camera and again breaks the fourth wall, and he says, "It never rains, it pours. To lose your only daughter and pet alligators all on the same black night." That's referring to the mood of Mr. Biddle at this point. You know, he's freaking, but everybody goes to sleep. Again, note the frozen alligators are lying all over the house.
Because they make fine decorations, Todd. Who yes. doesn't want a torpid alligator sitting next to the front door?
I agree.
Makes a lovely rug.
Indeed.
Footstool.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of uses.
TV stand. You could put a big screen on one of the bigger ones.
If you prop it up correctly, it could be an umbrella stand, you know.
A yeah. modern vase.
Indeed.
Very, very good.
That's right.
Nice.
Lots of 101 uses for an alligator. Let's
if
write
you
that
have
book.
Uses for corporate alligators, please tweet us at DizFilmProject.
Please.
But as black as the night was when they wake up the next morning, Mr. Biddle realizes he was a little rough on Cordy after the alligators wake up.
That's right. So it's really great. The new maid, the Biddles are woken up to an alarm clock, because I don't think they had an alarm clock back then. Maybe they had the windy bell type. I don't know. But the new maid is screaming at the top of her lungs. Okay? And he goes, and Mr. Biddle goes, "I don't know what's wrong, but the stuff that she colors her hair with must have gone to her brain." Because she's a bleached blonde, the new one. But and this is, then we have the alligator roundup, as I like to call it, where the Biddles are all running around the house along with John Lawless, and they're roping alligators and they're hog tying them. And there's this great moment where Greer Garson just points at one of them and goes, "You, into the conservatory." And she goes, "No, no, no, into the conservatory." And it runs right into the conservatory.
Yeah, the funny thing is,
I love that.
Yes, yes, it worked.
And then Cordy goes, "You're her mother." And then the next one goes, too.
That's right.
That's cute.
But it's really the rescue or the resuscitation of the alligators that puts Mr. Biddle in the right humor to realize how hard he was on Cordy and accept the fact that she's engaged and ask to see Angie.
That's right. Which leads us to the dinner.
Yes, which is an but we forgot, like, John Lawless gets to sing his favorite song again, and Bree just, I know,
wait,
was
clapping
for joy.
And he dances with George.
Oh, please.
He and George dance. George dances. If you watch this scene, this is like my favorite scene because George dances. I don't think you've ever seen a dancing alligator, folks. This
George did not dance in my version.
He does a little, like, rock back and forth.
He does a rock back and forth twice.
Yeah, they kind of move him forward and backwards on the couch.
Oh, okay. I don't know if I saw
it. It's cute.
But yes, that Angie is invited over for dinner, and he's, of course, intimidated by Mr. Biddle, who is a, you know, a boxer and who keeps alligators. There's a lot to be intimidated by. And the funny thing is, Cordy gives him the advice of, like, look, you have to just stand right up to him. That's the only thing he's going to respect. No matter what he says, you disagree with him. And Angie is not really certain that this is the right advice to take. But he goes with it, and it actually works out really, really well for him, despite the fact that we mentioned the, you know, keep your chin tucked and guard. What was it? What was the phrase, Ton?
Oh, your chin tucked and your guard up, and then and bring one up from the floor.
And so that they start.
They start to have a boxing match.
Boxing.
That's right. So they start to have a boxing match, and it's clear that Angie's never boxed before. But the reason why they start to have a boxing match is because. Angie, in his mind, while standing up to Mr. Biddle, actually says he actually belittles the sport of boxing.
Right.
Okay.
That's my favorite scene. That whole scene right there. I love it.
It is a very entertaining scene. And so he goes, "Oh, really?" And he goes, "Get the gloves." And so John Lawless goes and comes back with the gloves, right? And they put on the gloves and they start to have their little boxing thing. And he's kind of he's not hitting Angie like he had with the Marine. He's kind of just tapping him every time, going, you know, this would have been a hit to the chest. This would have been a hit to the face. You got to keep your guard up. Do this. And Cordy's back there going, put your chin up, tuck your chin in, you know, hold your fists up, do the whole thing, and dance around, that whole thing. And Angie eventually ends up accidentally knocked onto the floor. Okay, and he gets back up and he goes, and they take the gloves off him and they kind of sort of end the whole match. And he goes, and Mr. Biddle says something, and I forget exactly what it was.
I hope you're not angry with me. And Angie says, no. Well, if I was angry with you, I would take care of you.
Correct. And this is where, and he goes, oh really? How? And he goes,
He just says, I'd take care of you.
I'd take care of you.
And Mr. Biddle says, well, I'm very interested to see how that would happen. And that's when Angie breaks out his jujitsu.
That's right, his jujitsu. I couldn't remember what it was.
You can't make this stuff up.
That's right. And he goes, and Mr. Biddle goes, is that like wrestling? And he goes, yeah, it's a little like wrestling. So they start to take wrestling stances, which are like when you kind of circle a gun and you go to your crowd. It's you see it in modern wrestling, as I like to call it, and you see it in high school wrestling, you know, which is what real wrestling is, high school wrestling versus the stuff you watch on Turner stations.
No, we don't have wrestling anymore.
You don't have wrestling anymore? Oh, you don't?
No.
I thought you did. What are we watching on USA and stuff like that then?
Yes.
I know we watch it, but you know, everything's DVR'd for me. I don't actually watch live television anymore, so I have no clue what stations things are actually on.
Except for March Madness, which is on TBS.
What station is Phineas and Ferb on?
Well,
Disney
Channel, though originally Disney XD, right?
Yes.
Disney Channel, then Disney XD.
Oh, was it?
It started on Disney Channel, and then it went.
Oh, did it?
Yeah. But it's all Disney awesomeness.
It is indeed. But the whole fact that Angie knows a fighting hand-to-hand combat skill that Mr. Biddle doesn't know basically wins him over, wins Mr. Biddle over, and says that, okay, you can be engaged now.
Yes. And so Cordelia goes, when can we announce the engagement? And he's like, right away. And so the engagement gets announced.
And they go to New York to meet Angie's family, where we get yet another complication. Because we get to meet the most evil character in the film. And I believe all of our opinions. Am I correct here?
If I was Angie, I would have done jujitsu on her.
Yes.
Which would be Angie's mother, played by Geraldine Page.
Yes, Sarah Pearson Anger.
Yeah.
Evil.
Sarah Duke at this point. But
correct. But we could go through a whole long because the sequence takes quite a bit of time. But the basic idea, to sum it up, is that she is not pleased necessarily with this match. She thinks that there should be better of Angie, and she thinks the Biddles are crazy. And that,
right.
And she makes several condescending comments and does her best to plan tons and tons of events where Angie and Cordy are not together. And it's more about being in the high society and the papers and all those sorts of things than about celebrating the two of them getting married.
That's absolutely correct.
And to get to that point takes, what, about 30 minutes?
It's actually – there's this huge montage of parties in New York to celebrate the engagement. And it basically ends at a point where Cordelia is kind of sort of spent from the whole thing. She's Mrs. Duke there is trying to eat up all of Angie's time instead of letting Angie spend time with Cordy, which is what the engagement's supposed to be about.
Right.
He's stealing her time because he is very much a mama's boy. That's one of the fundamental problems that's going on, to the point where, let me point out that his name, Angier Buchanan Duke, okay, her last name, her maiden name is Angier, right? And she marries Benjamin Duke, okay? So she's Angier Duke, and she names her son Angier Duke.
Right.
Which is like, there's a definite problem right there to begin with.
So his name is Angier Duke.
No, yeah. basically. That's right. That's actually a good point that you make, because back then, the family name was always a hyphenated name back then. It wasn't until the middle of last century when you stopped using hyphenated names, and then towards the end of last century where hyphenated names tended to come back in some cases.
Right.
But so that they go through that whole thing in New York, and then when they come back to Philadelphia for the wedding is kind of where things kind of hit their peak, where Cordy finds out that, you know, Mrs. Duke is kind of, how shall I put this, evil.
Yes.
Because she's making very mean comments about her father in the garden. And then, but you do have a wonderful scene between Cordy and Aunt Mary, or rather...
Aunt Mary and Mrs. Duke. Yes.
Which is, there's a song, I can't remember the name of the song.
Called There Are Those.
Yes.
That was funny.
And I love this song because it's so here's what's going on. Okay, is New York is high society, right? And but the Biddles are from Philadelphia, and Philadelphia is old society, right? The Biddles are one of the oldest families in the United States. They came over in the 1600s. They've been around. They were there during all the initial independence wars, the Civil War, all of that. Their family has been a part of Philadelphia society forever. Okay, so you have old society versus new high society, and this is the clash that's going on, and it's in this song where, you know, and it's beautiful. But my favorite point is John Lawless is asked to get them drinks and food in the middle of the song, and he comes in with the tray of food and the drinks, and he's trying to give them stuff, but he starts saying things, and at one point he goes, "Poison dart? I mean, raisin tart."
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable for him to be caught between these two older women, just, you know, kind of throwing verbal daggers at each other, and he's in there trying to offer them, you know, cucumber sandwiches.
That's right.
Not exactly what he wanted, but that scene is kind of what leads to Aunt Mary shows up, and then John, the Biddles come in to greet her in the parlor. And that's where Cordy finds out that rather than following his dreams and going to Detroit, Angie has decided to join the family business. And she basically is done at that point and calls the wedding off.
Right. Well, first she threatens elopement, then she calls the wedding off.
Right.
That's so Angie gets gets upset too, and he storms off, and all this stems from the fact that there's I guess the box of invitations from the Dukes was misplaced, potentially on purpose, and never sent out to invite the Dukes from New York to come, or all over, actually, because it's North Carolina and New York, right, or where the Dukes are primarily from, and which plays into the real life story, and we'll get to that.
We're all snobby in New York.
I'm aware of that. I was up there and you didn't even come see me.
Oh, well, you know, you could have come see me too, but I'm just saying.
I didn't have a car.
Well, you could use your superhuman powers. What are you, you know?
Okay.
Mr. Underdog. Actually, super canine powers.
Speed of lightning, roar
yes,
of thunder, fighting all who rob or plunder. Underdog. Sorry.
Okay, that's going to do it for this week's show. I hope you enjoyed our look at Underdog. Okay, anyway.
That's a different Disney movie.
Yes, different's a good word. Angie does what any good man would do in this situation.
And he goes to Casey's bar.
He goes to the bar, yes.
And Mr. Bill sends John to go follow Angie, may we add.
Yeah, and may I say, from a strategy point of view, not the best move on Mr. Biddle's part. Sending an Irishman to a bar.
Yes. Though it
not
makes
what you want to do.
It makes for the best scene in the entire movie, though, in my opinion.
Wow, do I disagree with that. But go ahead.
Yeah, I disagree too.
I love this. I love this. This is my favorite song in the whole movie.
Yeah, no.
Todd does like it because he convinces the barkeep that Angie's bad.
That's right. John Lawless gets a pile of money on the table and gets Angie playing through the entire bar's round of drinks over and over again. If you notice that throughout the song, he keeps pointing at the money, and the bartender takes more money and gives drinks to everybody else every single time. It's very interesting.
John basically comes up with the plan to somehow keep Angie in town. Because Angie is talking about going to China and joining the Foreign Legion and doing all these different things. And so John keeps convincing him the song is Let's Have a Drink on it. And so he keeps convincing him to drink and trying to keep him in town, and eventually ends up starting a bar fight and getting Angie thrown in jail just to keep him around long enough to try and resolve the issues between him and Cordy.
Right. And John is intentionally, he's not drinking every single time that Angie drinks, and he's swapping the glasses with him. And so for every set of drinks they get, Angie is drinking both of them the entire time.
And so they sing this Let's Have a Drink on It song and do a fine dancing musical number in a bar that I believe goes on for two and a half hours.
Yes.
It's about 4 minutes.
I think that was the longest song. That was the longest song in the entire film, I think.
Yeah,
Detroit still wins.
I was watching it. This was shortly before we started. And yeah, it's long. It's long. I mean, there's amusing moments like what you're talking about with him swapping the drink and all that kind of stuff. But wow, it's long.
I just enjoy the sight gags in it is part of it. I mean, because it's to me, it's a fun moment, and it's coming after a lot of like not so fun moments in the movie. It's a lot of just, you know, dialogue, and some of it is very sad, and some of the things that are going on are not as high note as they were in the beginning of the movie. And then you come back to this. And it's actually, I think it's like a high pickup moment in the movie, which is probably why I enjoy it so much.
That scene reminded me a lot of, for some reason, West Side Story with the stylized fighting. To me, that's what it seemed like. Although, you know, it went to dancing and then into fighting, you know?
It reminded me of Popeye. Remember the Popeye movie with Robin Williams? Anybody?
Yeah.
Yes.
Remember the bar fight in that movie? Reminded me of that. It's just
if only they had spinach.
Exactly.
We're getting this.
Apparently, Todd needs his spinach, is what I'm getting from this. So Angie ends up in jail, and the next morning, Mr. Biddle and the whole family have to come and bail him out.
Yes.
And Mr. Biddle, at this point, has realized sort of that he never really has been 100% behind the marriage, with the urging of his beautiful bride, the elder Cordelia, to get him to this realization.
Greer Garson says, she says, you've been yourself in spades. And he goes, where do you get that kind of backroom talk or slang or something like that? And she goes, well, I've been around myself or something like that afterwards. So
Greer Garson, awesome.
Again, amazing at delivering lines. She actually doesn't have a ton of lines in the movie compared to everybody else, but everyone she says is just said amazing.
At that point, he decides that the way to get Angie to do what he needs to do is to tell him to come out and accept his responsibilities, because obviously, based on what happened the previous evening, that would be the exact opposite of what would fix the situation. So Mr. Biddle telling him to accept his responsibility and join the family business inspires Angie to instead elope with Cordy and go to Detroit. But Cordy is not buying it, which I thought was pretty interesting, because she, again, the tension through the whole film is that she believes that her father is sort of manipulating everything, which is kind of true.
Yeah.
You know?
But he eventually tells her that she has to live her own life.
Right. And so Angie decides that, you know what, I'll prove it to you, and he throws Cordy over her shoulder and takes her out, and that is where the shorter version of the film ends.
Yes.
For those of us lucky enough to have an extra 25 minutes to go.
Enlighten me, dear people.
Mr. and Mrs. Biddle return home, and Mr. Biddle kind of doesn't know what to do with himself because all the kids are gone. And there's a fun part where Miss Cordelia says, you know, well, perhaps we should travel. And he says, yes, we can go to Detroit and see Angie and Cordy. And she just kind of looks at him like, yeah, you're not getting this.
Let it go. Cut the cord.
They sing a song called Let Them Go, or It Won't Be Long Till Christmas.
Christmas, yes.
Aww.
Basically saying, you know, hey, you got to let the kids go. And then we bring up the long missing brothers. for no apparent reason.
Yes.
Mention them again. That hey, we should go. We should see them. They'll be. And she's like, no, they'll be home for Christmas.
Christmas. Okay. Yes.
Settle down.
Oh, so you guys got closure. I was wondering where those darn brothers were.
Yeah, you got driving off into the burning pit. The burning picture of Detroit. That's like the worst picture of Detroit ever, isn't it? It's just smokestacks with smoke and a orange glow behind it.
And so then the Marines return for no apparent reason, but they show Mr. Biddle a note, and he is informed that he is now a member of the Marine Corps, and he will be going to Paris Island to train the recruits in hand-to-hand combat.
Wow.
Which is exactly what he wanted, and he suddenly has purpose in his life.
See, I didn't get closure.
And so now, do you want the punchline? That's the end of the film in the long version. And now, everyone, do you want the punchline? This all happened.
Yes.
Real life.
Well, some of it happened.
Okay, what I just described with Marines showing up out of nowhere and him going to Paris Island to train people in hand-to-hand combat,
yes, that happened.
Yes.
Alligators happened. Angie and Cordy happened.
Well, yes. They kind of sort of happened. They kind of got divorced.
Let's all take it in order. Let's not say it all at once, folks.
Yeah.
Okay. So the important thing is this is a book that is based on a book called My Philadelphia Father, written by Cordelia Drexel Biddle, okay? Or Cordelia Drexel Biddle Duke, who is Cordy in the movie, okay? It's autobiographical because it's about her life, and it's biographical because it's about her father. And that's why they're the primary two characters in the book, okay? And his full name is Anthony Joseph Drexel Biddle Sr., okay? As I said earlier. It was adapted to a musical, okay, by Kyle Crichton and Cordelia herself, okay? And then the play starred Walter Pigeon, and I just wanted to mention that it was Walter Pigeon because Walter Pigeon is Dr. Morbius from Forbidden Planet, which is another one of my favorite science fiction movies. So,
gotta give props to Walter Pigeon.
You really do.
Absolutely.
Especially since Dr. Morbius is one of the greatest all-time science fiction characters ever, so. And I'll let that go now. Okay.
Another film I have not seen. Moving on.
It was then finally turned into a musical, a movie version of the musical by Disney. It's also the last film to have personal involvement from Walt of any sort.
Right.
And to the point where I love. There's this in an interview with Robert Sherman later on. The very last time he saw Disney, he mentions in an interview that I found this little anecdote, and I thought I would read it. He said he was up in the third floor of the animation building after a run-through of Happiest Millionaire, he meaning Walt, okay? He usually held court up in the hallway afterward for people involved with the picture, and he started talking to them, telling what he liked and what they should change, and then when they were through, he turned to us with a big smile and said, "Keep up the good work, boys," and then he walked into his office, and that was the last they ever saw of him.
Mm.
So... it was literally he died while this movie was, you know, in production.
And so that the fact that this was the last one that Walt had personal experience in, I think is a very good point. So I'm going to get on my soapbox for a second. I've heard a bajillion times that Walt Disney did not do sequels. I've heard the famous quote about the fact of they made the Three Little Pigs, and it was supremely successful. And Walt was asked, you know, well, can we get more pigs movies? And he said no. None of that is true. This is not a slam on Walt Disney. It's a slam on the people who try to capitalize on his reputation and bash the company today. Happiest Millionaire is an attempt to relive the magic of Mary Poppins.
Yeah, it is.
Exactly what it is, because there is so much, and not in a bad way. I'm not saying that as a slam on the movie. It is a good movie. It's not Mary Poppins good, but it's a good movie. But, I mean, that's what it is. And the fact that Walt Disney was involved with it should put to rest the fact that Walt didn't do sequels. No, this isn't a sequel to Mary Poppins, but it is an attempt to recapture that same feeling, down to the fact of John Lawless being an Irishman who sings and dances and talks to the camera. The difference being he's not Cockney, he's Irish.
And he's actually Irish, as opposed to
yes.
Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah, a little bit believable, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
But and for those who don't realize, there were several sequels to Three Little Pigs, but that's another topic for another day. But that that's my little soapbox thing. I really dislike it when people try to use Walt Disney and say, well, Walt would never have approved of a sequel, or he never would have made a movie that was similar to that movie. He always wanted to do the next new thing. Yes, Walt tried to do the next new thing, but he also went back to the well on occasion.
Yeah. It's also Walt loved Leslie Ann Warren and John Davidson as a couple. He paraded them about almost the entire time this movie was being made. He went to press events. He took them with him. There's all sorts of pictures of them on the stairs of the steps and in the conservatory and things like that. And he just this couple was a couple that he put together, and he felt this was going to be his next great couple. Of course, it didn't actually happen. They made one more movie together, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
Which is
a good couple.
Yeah, they are a very nice looking couple. I don't think the characters did as well together necessarily, but they look good together, like especially when they're dancing in the dancing scene. Yeah.
Yes.
So speaking of the characters, in real life.
So Anthony Joseph Drexel Beale Sr. Comes, as we said, from one of the oldest families in Pennsylvania. Okay. He really is as eccentric as the movie showed. Okay.
Oh, folks, dear.
This is 100% real. He really kept alligators as pets.
Oh, my.
He really loved boxing.
And really did Bible boxing class.
In fact, he formed a movement called called Athletic Christianity. Okay. And it had 300,000 members worldwide.
Yep.
Okay. At its peak. However, unlike in the movie where he gets offered a provisional captainship at the end, he was an actual colonel. He was a real officer in the Marines. He joined at 41 years old. Okay. And he became a lieutenant colonel in 1934. So the movie is taking place ends in 1917, which is when he joined in real life. Okay. Because that's when he was 41. He was already considered an expert at close combat. Okay. And we're showing again how eccentric he is. He would face off against his trainees barehanded against their bayonets. So that he would use his fists against their rifles with knives on the end of them, okay? He only ever had one serious injury from doing that, okay, which was where he got his wrist cut, and it knocked him out for 2 months, basically. He was in the infirmary. He taught a modified form of fencing that used the bayonet that he invented, okay? So he combined bayonet fighting with fencing to create this whole new form of close combat.
He's my new hero.
Okay. He had boxing tees in his home, okay, to face off against other boxers, and then he would invite them to dinner. So that scene in the movie where they go into the stable and do the boxing and then go to have dinner with each other, that was real.
That's why I was saying, like, when we got to the end of the movie, this all happened. I mean, like, yeah. Not, you know, they dramatized it and, you know, they put a Sherman Brothers songs to it and that sort of thing. But all the crazy things we're talking about happened.
In 1955, Sports Illustrated called him boxing's greatest amateur.
Wow.
Okay, so they actually recognized him for his boxing skills and everything like that. Now, as I said, Angier Buchanan Duke was the son of Benjamin Newton Duke and Sarah Pearson Angier Duke. Okay, when Cheryl's talking about the sad part of this is, so first of all, the actual real character by the time he met Cordelia was missing his hand and part of his arm. Because he was a bit of a daredevil and did really dumb things, okay? Mm. And he actually died in 1923, in a boating accident because he had lost his hand and arm. He actually
drowned.
Okay, and that's how their marriage actually ended.
No, they got divorced.
Oh, they got divorced before that? Okay, yeah, they got divorced before that. Okay.
Yeah, they did not have a happy marriage.
Yes.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
So now, Benjamin Newton Duke was one of the two sons of Washington Duke, okay? And he and his brother James Buchanan Duke owned the American Tobacco Company, which was one of the original monopolies that was broken up by the federal government into all the smaller companies. They also basically are together, the Duke family is responsible for the industrialization of the Durham, North Carolina area. They brought the Piedmont Power Plant online. The original power plant, not what's currently there today. and its power company was called Duke Power.
They are the Dukes of Duke.
Right, so now here's the important thing. They formed the initial endowment that formed Duke University. Okay, so yes, these Dukes are the Dukes of Duke University. All of them had some job on the board of trustees for this at one point in time in their life, including Angier himself, his son, who's also Angier Biddleduke, and on and on and on.
And they were all apparently Blue Devils, is what I understand.
They also were the benefactors. Benjamin himself, who is Angier's dad, was also the benefactor of Trinity College as well. That's basically that for them. The other thing is, Anthony Joseph, this was the two marriages between these families, not just the one portrayed in the movie. The younger son, Tony, okay, who's Andrew, Anthony Joseph Drexel Biddle Jr., married Mary Lillian Duke, who is the younger sister of Angier, or Angie, okay?
I didn't know that.
Two marriages here. Anthony Jr., okay, was the envoy to Norway, the ambassador to Poland during World War II. He actually was trapped in Poland for much of the war because Poland had become locked off from everyone else. When he got out, he served on Eisenhower's staff, and he became he eventually ended up retiring as the adjunct general to the Pennsylvania National Guard. Okay.
Wow.
And as I mentioned Angier Duke being the protocol officer under Kennedy. Later on, Angier, this is the son of Cordelia and Angie, okay? He also was the ambassador to Spain, the ambassador to Denmark, the ambassador to Morocco, and he died in a rollerblading accident at the age of 79 years old.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, why wouldn't you be rollerblading at 79?
I have no idea.
Especially if you had been infected with the Biddle clan, I could see that happening.
I suppose that's true.
One of your alligators behind you also on roller skates.
Of course.
Yeah.
And that's the real life stuff right there. I mean, this is real.
which is mind-blowing. If you see the movie, like when you watch the movie, you don't think about that. And then like it sort of hits you, not the breaking into song, of course, but the rest of the stuff that's going on is actually real. And it's kind of disturbing, I'm not going to lie.
It is.
It is.
So, as I mentioned earlier, the movie takes place in Philadelphia, New York City, because they never actually show them getting to Detroit, so we can just say Philadelphia, New York City. It started in September 1916, ended in June 1917, just after Woodrow Wilson had Congress declare war for World War I, as we said. The Biddle home is real. Okay, so the 2104 that you see at the thing was actually their home at 2104 Walnut Street in Philadelphia. Okay, it's valued at $800,000 on Zillow. Okay, and it is a home currently to a hair salon, among other things. There's a really famous hair salon that's in there right at the moment. I just don't remember the name of it. The phone booth from the foyer that they're in.
Oh, I know this one.
Right, where is it?
It is in Club 33.
Apparently, we need to get press access into there.
Yes, that's right. I think that has to happen.
Put that on the docket, Miss Producer Woman.
There we go.
I also like that the decor and set pieces from Clancy's Bar from the Let's Have a Drink of It scene are also used in Cafe Orleans at Disneyland.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Those I have seen. Yes. I have not seen the phone booth.
I've seen pictures of the phone booth, but I've not seen the phone booth. It's
right.
up close.
This movie actually, like we talked about the fact that Fortuosity is in the Main Street Loop, you know, and then you just mentioned the other stuff. It fits right in with the Main Street theme.
I'd like to point out that Let's Have a Drink on It is also on the Main Street USA Loop.
Yes, it is.
In all Disneyland parks, Disneyland-oriented parks. So that's
and
Magic
there's one more song Disney, that's Disney, in – there's almost also one more song – something about the Detroit song is in Rocket Rods.
Well, Rocket Rods doesn't exist anymore. It was like okay. Open and closed. It was like a failed ride, but it was actually used in the queue of Rocket Rods.
Yeah, it was there. Rocket Rods was open for about 2 weeks.
I think the track, only thing the only
the
thing
track
that's been,
is still up there.
Yeah, the only thing that's been open shorter than that was Stitch's Supersonic Celebration.
Yeah, 2 days.
What are you people talking about?
Yeah, Rocket Rods was the ride that replaced the People Mover in the Tomorrowland of Disneyland.
Oh.
The track still stands. People want something done with it. It's huge controversy in the online community.
Okay.
Probably in the non-online community as well, but I don't read their stuff online, so because they're non-online.
That made no sense, but okay.
Well, it's true.
Are they not? They're not sending you their paper bulletins.
Wait,
we'll have to fix that. All of you anti Rocket Rods folks, please send your mail, snail mail, to Todd Perlmutter.
Yes. At 1313 Mockingbird Lane in Beverly Hills, California, 90210.
There you go.
I wanted to go back and talk about one of the sons that's actually living.
Okay.
Cordy's younger son is still living. Has a book called Uncharted Course, The Voyage of My Life. There's a webpage here I'll give to Ryan for notes.
Okay.
There's a couple of videos here as well. And then he also founded the Boys and Girls Harbor as well.
What is that?
Boys and Girls Club.
Okay, Boys and Girls Club. Okay, that's fine.
He founded a Boys and Girls Club, and he's on Facebook. I thought that was interesting.
Well, of course he is, because we're all on Facebook these days.
Yeah, but maybe we should friend him. And so we like the movie, but we don't know, he might not like the movie.
I wanted to mention that Mr. Biddle was also portrayed for his bayonet fighting that I mentioned earlier. Okay, in a documentary about the Marine Corps called Soldiers of the Sea. So he's not just portrayed in this movie. He's actually in this documentary as well, for part of it, not the whole thing. It's not just a documentary about him; it's about the Marines, but it's got a section on it about him, which I'd love to find footage for. If anybody can point me at a link, that would be cool to watch.
I could ask Mr. Duke Senior. He may
Cheryl.
Yes, Cheryl's his friend on Facebook.
I'll ask a question of anybody. Sure, whatever you want
to ask. And to drive home the similarity point about Mary Poppins to this movie is the dancing, staging, all that, all the choreography of the movie of this movie was done by Mark Breaux and D.D. Wood, who did Mary Poppins, Sound of Music, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, all these movies that are just very similar in this vein. Okay, and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang is also the Sherman Brothers, right?
Right.
So again, there's this whole constant tie of why these movies have that similar feel and to them, and probably why you feel the same level of warmth towards these movies, generally speaking.
Yeah, I felt like this movie reminds me a lot. This movie feels older than Mary Poppins or some of those movies that you're talking about. It feels much more like I'm going to bring up a movie that I doubt you guys have seen, but like Meet Me in St. Louis or some of those movies from the late 30s, early 40s that were similar to this, about, you know, rich society, people falling in love, musicals that don't really like this movie has a story, but it's not that important to the movie. It's very much a series of, we talked about in Mary Poppins, it's a series of vignettes. That movie has a central premise that kind of connects everything. This one does, but it's not nearly as important, nor is it, you know, quite frankly, as relevant as Mary Poppins. And I think that's where it sort of suffers for me.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say that in the staggering 17-hour length.
Right. Well, there's a better story going on in Mary Poppins, but I do think that there's a lot of things about this movie that make it, to me, a little bit more fun than the whole of Mary Poppins, but there are very, very fun moments in Mary Poppins overall that are more fun than this movie as a whole.
Right.
Does that make sense?
No, that makes sense. I don't agree with it, but it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. That's fine.
No, that's why we all watch different movies. That's the whole
thing. Yeah. Well, I'm just saying that this movie is more consistently fun, whereas Mary Poppins is kind of sort of a very roller coaster ride of a movie.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
Now, a film that you guys might not have seen is Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. I don't know if you guys have ever seen that with, I think it was Cary Grant and Myrna Loy.
Not heard of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, not heard of that one.
Okay, yeah, it reminds me of like a musical version of that. But again, that was from the 30s, so I can kind of see where you're going with that, Ryan.
Yeah, I mean, it just feels like there was a lot of those. Meet Me in St. Louis is my favorite of them, but there was a lot of movies like that that are about high society, people that don't have to work, you know, families, musical type films, but they were all released back in the, you know, in the 30s and 40s. And this reminded me a great deal of that. It's kind of like a version of that 30 years later or so.
I don't know. I'm reminded of the Gold Diggers movies. So,
the one with Gold Diggers?
Yeah. When all the, it's like from the type of movies with Footlight Parade where you see in the Hollywood
Studios,
right?
Yes.
But they were called the Gold Diggers movies, and they made like one for every year, and it was about a bunch of girls who were trying to find men to marry, and they were all dancers and actresses and stuff like that inside the movie. You know, so there was...
Right. Yeah. All right,
that's
so
cool.
What are we going to rate Happiest Millionaire? I will start...
5.5, 6, 10, I don't know, the highest ever.
I was gonna start with Cheryl because this is her favorite movie.
Best movie ever. What can you say? It has dancing alligators. It has, I don't know, dancing alligators.
Frozen alligators. It's got alligators.
It's got corporate alligators.
It's got boxing.
It's got George. George is the best.
George rocks.
Cheryl wants a pet alligator. Wait. See, we have a pet alligator, see?
Oh.
The little plastic alligator does not count.
Is his name what? George?
Look, he's biting my finger.
and you're going to sing for sympathy.
Where's my wife?
Think about it.
All right, Bree, what are you going to rate The Happiest Millionaire?
I am going to give it a 3. I did enjoy it very much. I am more of a fan of Mary Poppins, and you know I see the similarities there. More so of a fan of Mary Poppins, but I did enjoy this. It was fun. I had a lot of laughs, and as I said before, my favorite scene was between Angie and Mr. Biddle. I got mixed up with the Drixel and Biddle and whatever. Anyway, yeah, so 3.
Understood. Mr. Yeah. Perlmutter, I think you're legally required to give it a 5, aren't you?
Well, am I? I don't know. I'm entitled to my opinion. I kind of like Mary Poppins better, too, though. So
you can't have any Tafuti cones for us a month. There you go.
I was gonna say, you're entitled to your opinion. She's entitled to edit your opinion out. So.
That's true. She is. No, I mean, so what did I give Mary Poppins, like a 4.5? Because everybody killed me for saying that, right? So, I would have to say that this is not as good as Mary Poppins, but I would say that because of the enjoyment that I have watching it with Cheryl and seeing Cheryl light up watching it, I would probably give it probably like a 4.25.
He's splitting hairs now, people.
I'm at a 5.
It's not like Cheryl is, you know, in another state. She's in the other room. So I would go with 5 if I were you. I'm just saying.
She can throw tofuti. It gets violent.
Wait. 3, 2, 1. A 5. I give it a 5.
There you go. You learned. I will agree with Bree and give it a 3. I think the movie has a lot of potential. It's just too long, and we've made that joke plenty of times. But I can see why it didn't play in theaters and why they did so many different edits to it and cut the length down and that sort of thing. It's just, you know, like Bree said, Fortuosity and I'll Always Be Irish and Let's Have a Drink on It. Those songs in Detroit, Todd, you mentioned. I mean, the songs go on for a little too long and sometimes don't portray quite the point that they're trying to, I think. But I also agree with you, Bree. Like, it's a fun movie to watch. I mean, it's an enjoyable time, and I had a good time watching it. I am no longer regretting the $20 that I spent to get it on DVD from Amazon to get here in time.
Oh.
Enjoy it.
Your kids will like it, Ryan. I think your kids will love it.
You are correct. My daughter watched the first hour of it with me yesterday, and she was enraptured with it. So she was very much enjoyed it.
Bree, I have a question.
Yes.
To go with your Herbie necklace that you were looking for, are you going to get a Biddle Bible class?
I should. I totally should. And then on the back of it, I'm going to have George Bitney.
George Bibby, yes.
I believe we should all have little Bible class sweaters for our first meet. Whenever
we'd have to be Torah, we'd have to put Torah.
No, Torah means Bible. It's fine.
I don't know. They'd have to be Torah. There are no Bible classes, Todd.
Yes.
It's Torah class. It's Torah study.
Yes.
Mine should say Bible.
Yeah. So Bree and I'll have the Bible class ones, and you'll have the bit old Torah class. That's all right.
There you go.
Well, the I'll Always Be Irish song, I started in my head doing lyrics to I'll Always Be Jewish, just so you know.
And on that note, thank you for joining us this week.
Next week, we will be doing Fiddler on the Roof.
Yeah. all right, so that's going to wrap up The Happiest Millionaire. Good recommendation, Cheryl. Much obliged to you for exposing me to this one.
Yeah, well,
yes.
I've seen it before. It was an enjoyable experience, and I look forward to
Hey, it was Saturday in Beverly Hills Chihuahua 1 and 2. That's all I have to tell you all.
Really? Like, that's going to be your bar that you're going to compare this to?
It was better than Three Life. It was better than Zach and Cody.
That's not a bar, though, Cheryl. That's like the book you're propping up the corner of your couch with.
Yeah. I don't know. It's been Herbie, Fully Loaded.
Whoa.
Well, I liked Herbie Fully Loaded.
Better.
All right, we're gonna have to discuss this later. all right, so next week we'll talk about a different movie. So that's going to wrap up this week's show. Thank you for listening, everyone. And if you like the show, please recommend it to a friend. Download it from all the various and sundry locations that you can. Go to Disney Film Project. You can do that. You can keep up with us on Twitter. @DisFilmProject is our Twitter account. So send us tweets and tell us what you think. If you like the show, if you don't like the show, then why are you pestering us? Keep up with us at Adventures of Bree at adventuresofbree.blogspot.com for Bree. Todd with his inimitable blogs on touringplans.com. I don't know what the word inimitable means, but I guarantee you that his blogs are that. My blogs on touringplans.com or at DisneyFilmProject.com or DisneyDrivenLife.com and the chief technical stuff that Todd does to make sure that I can do those things. Is much obliged. And everyone give a round up for Cheryl and send Cheryl a tweet and tell her you appreciate the fact that she spends long hours editing these shows, because trust me, like, she's gonna have her work cut out for her. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. We've had a lot of fun doing them, so thank you very much, and until next week, goodbye, and enjoy your torpid alligator decorations.
Bye, guys.
Bye, pum pum.